First of all, my name is Randy Astle. I've been picking the films and directing this portion of the symposium this weekend. I'm almost done writing a book about Mormon film. I've been working on it for 13 years, so hopefully I'm close. And I've seen about 1,200 movies related to Mormonism, and this is in my top three. So I'm really excited that we were able to show it. The other two are New York Doll and Joseph Smith, the Man, T.C. Christensen's short film, and they're all the same film when you think about it. But this was really unprecedented. Well, before we get into that, I'd like to introduce you guys. I have Sterling Van Wagenen, whose name you saw as a producer of the film. We showed another one of your films 2 days ago, Reserved to Fight, about war, Iraq veterans and PTSD. And you've been everywhere with church films and fiction and nonfiction films and teaching and all sorts of things. Alex Nibley, the son of Hugh Nibley, who was a writer, and I don't know what other jobs you did on this film. We're going to talk about that. You teach at UVU, yeah. As does Boyd. You teach in the film department, and Boyd is the head of the Mormon Studies program down there and the author of Hugh Nibley's biography. And you've written the book about Hugh Nibley's war service. So I'm going to hand the mic over and not say anything else. Where did the idea, the concept for this film come from? Whose idea was it? Because it's an unlikely kind of a thing.
Actually, the idea probably needs to be credited more to Jack Welch.
Okay.
Jack had an idea. Mm-hmm. Well, we kind of had. Jack had an idea. He wanted to do a document. He said, let's really do it right and you know, get some budget behind it. And, you know, if it takes $5,000, we'll make it happen.
Make five films.
then Sterling got involved and it took a long time and it was, you know, there were problems on a few different levels. Eventually, Sterling was very instrumental in making it happen. Mm-hmm. I was very young and had not a clue what I was doing, and I as soon as I talked to Jack, I got a hold of Sterling, mm-hmm. and Sterling was very instrumental in making it happen.
Jack was working through farms.
This was the early days of farms, okay. and this was when farms was Jack's little cubbyhole in the law school and a Xerox machine and a file cabinet. That was farms at that point.
Okay.
We took it from there, and Sterling can probably give you more information about how the nuts and bolts of how it got made from there.
Well, is this working? Can you hear us back there? Good. Actually, Alex's comment just triggered a memory for me. I remember one of the first places we went to find money for the project was to Dallin Oaks, who at the time was president of BYU. I remember having a conversation with Elder Oaks, and he said, you know, I think it's really a nice thing that you want to make a film about one of your teachers, one of your favorite teachers, but I just don't think we have the money to support it. And that was sort of the first door that got kind of slammed in the face, and I thought, you know, I don't think he understands. I don't think he quite gets what it is we're up to.
I had heard, I think it was Tom Leffler at BYU, who told me that someone had thought of doing a series of films about Mormon intellectuals and other professors at the Y or elsewhere, and that this was the only one that saw the light of day. This is your baby, and you wanted to go with it.
Well, we kind of hung in there, I guess. Sterling and I, and eventually Brian Kapner got involved, and Peter Johnson also, who was a friend of both mine and Sterling's, and was at the time running the motion picture studio, mm-hmm. and when he got behind it. So it was, you know, without any one of those people, it could not have been made. You know, Jack deserves a lot of credit for getting this film made. Peter also stuck his neck out and supported it. I wanted to have here today Pete Cherney,
yeah.
who's the one who actually assembled all the film we shot. Since that time, I've learned a whole lot about filmmaking, and I watched this, and there, you know, there are a lot of things I would do differently, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Peter, you know, after we got all this film, and getting the film was an interesting project. How we got to Egypt and how we got, you know, all the stuff that happened there, but also how we did the interviews. That was really me cutting my teeth on interviewing. I've interviewed a lot of people since then. I don't think I've interviewed anybody who's a harder interview than Hugh Nibley.
HughNibley.net calls it like wildlife photography.
Well, that was the concept we came up with.
Okay.
Was that we were going to do wildlife photography. And first of all, we had two interviewers. Sterling and I double teamed him.
Okay.
And even then, we were too few.
Outmanned.
But it worked. Sterling could challenge him intellectually, and he felt comfortable with Sterling as an intellectual match, as mm-hmm. you know, a very bright young man who could push him on points. I knew a lot of his personal background. And could try to touch on those points. Sometimes that worked, sometimes it didn't. But we did go so far that we actually hid the camera. He was not able to see the camera during the interviews. We put some sound baffles mm-hmm. together, and there was like a 10-inch gap that we shot through. And then when we got into something fairly sensitive, we would lie to him. And tell him they're changing film now, so don't worry. Go ahead and tell us that story.
Okay. That's an old standby trick.
Yeah, that's how we got a lot of the stuff. It was better then because you had to change film every 15 minutes.
Right.
In fact, one of the things about the film that's still a little painful for me is when Nibley's telling the story from the Midrash about Abraham going out into the desert to look for someone. We actually ran out of film in the middle of that Ooh. Interview, and we could see that he was getting very emotional.
Actually, the reason we cut was that there was a barge in the background. And it was going ka-chonk, 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 ka-chonk. They said, the audio stinks.
The audio's going to be
let's
right,
cut.
That's
you know.
Right. Yeah.
But this, the thing was that we had been in Egypt for 2 weeks. And after about 20 drafts of scripts and ideas that were all different, everyone included a trip to Egypt. Okay, we went to Egypt. We were there for 2 weeks, and we hadn't gotten the interview yet.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think part of the success of that particular moment is the fact that your dad was exhausted.
Yes,
he was really tired, so his defenses were down. He was really terrific at throwing up a wall when you tried to get too close emotionally. I see Zyner nodding her head there. Tried to get too close, and boy, he could throw. But in this particular case, he was really tired, and so he responded just beautifully, I thought.
And actually, he began to tell the story while the camera was not rolling. And
we'd stop. That's
Sterling,
right, we'd
stop. I saw Sterling engaged. This is where we've gotten to be a fairly tight team. And I saw Sterling engaged in an emotional conversation. I saw him getting emotional, and I couldn't even hear what was going on. But I turned to Brian and signaled to roll camera, and they rolled on it. And then I signaled to Sterling that we were rolling, and he took him backed him up and got him to retell part of it. But that was a very interesting moment of documentary filmmaking.
Yeah.
One where, again, we were there for 2 weeks. We had spent all this money, and we had not gotten the interview that we went there to get. And then, at the last minute, on the last day, it happened.
Mm-hmm.
It was, yeah.
Which is nice how that comes. And there was film in the camera. So
there was film in the camera. We were, yeah.
Which used to be the bane of documentary. I wanted to talk. I'm sorry, Pete's not here as well. I wanted to talk about the structure, the script versus post production. How did it get laid out in that order? With talking about education and the logging industry and the war and moving through his life like that, back towards ancient Egypt.
Go ahead.
Well, multiple edits, multiple drafts.
We did a series of interviews, and we focused each one on a topic. And when I say one of the things we did with this wildlife photography is that he would come into each interview session prepared to give a lecture.
Okay.
And one of my major objectives in doing the film was that I had seen that there are a lot of people who knew about him as a lecturer and as a writer, but that's not the way I knew him, and that's not the way he talked to me. And I wanted to capture that on camera, but he was very leery of that. So he would come in with a lecture prepared, and he would come in with a 2 hours worth of material. So we would schedule a 4-hour session, and we basically ran him down. Yeah.
And what's the percentage from his lecture versus the second 2 hours that you made it?
Well, you can hear if you sort of get used to his voice, you can hear sections where he is lecturing. There are places where he'll drop into a lecture, and it sounds very formal, like, you know, there was a drought, and, you know, there were bloody rites and all of that. That's sort of from the lecture material, and then the rest of it is, most of it is actually spontaneous. Yeah. We did, I think, about 40 hours. I don't know, Boyd, maybe you'd know better than I. We did about 40 hours worth of interviews.
I haven't seen the number of interviews, but I've seen the transcript, and it's huge.
It's huge, yeah.
And he wouldn't prepare an interview about his grandfather or about some of those more personal subjects. Biographical.
Yeah, and we would sketch out some of the stuff we wanted to get. Sometimes we'd get it, sometimes we wouldn't.
Yeah.
But we would plan in advance, you know, what Sterling was going to try to get and what I was going to try to get. For instance, I knew the near-death experience story. I wanted to get him to tell that. And the first time when I tried to get him to tell, I said, I'm not going to tell that story. And then later, a couple of interviews later, he's talking and he says, I never told you that story about what I... No, why don't you tell it? The camera's not rolling now, so go ahead. That was he did tell him the camera wasn't. But by the way, I will share with you. I've got... This is the guy that... the lawyer in there...
Paul Springer.
Paul Springer, yeah. He carried on a correspondence with Hugh for starting in like 1938, and this is the last letter that he ever wrote to Paul Springer in 1983. And this will give you an idea of what we were dealing with, trying to get him to participate in this movie. Okay, January 3rd, 1983. Parentheses, made it! ! It says, Sarah, here I was sinking into the grateful obscurity of a somewhat benign old age, and this thing breaks loose. You may not believe it, but this is the first definite information that I have on this insane project, if you call your broad hints and well-justified jibes information. What in hell is going on? Charles, Alex, that's me, is maddeningly uncommunicative, and I sense someone digging deeper beneath my crumbling battlements to blow me at the moon in some apocalyptic indiscretion. I can't imagine anything exciting or edifying in the life and times, and even less the works, of an uncomplicated beach boy.
So apocalyptic. Oh, go ahead.
They says towards the end, this is a few months before he gave his speech that we started this with, you know, the black robes of the false priesthood. He says, I am giving a commencement address this summer and intend to make myself irretrievably obnoxious. But I've got to put a stop to whatever it is Alex is up to. I did not settle in for the suffocating obscurity of Provo to attract public notice. But in our society, what difference does it make one way or another? That's one of the other functions that I served on the movie, is that I had to kind of get his cooperation, which was spotty. You know, he would say, I'm not going to do this. I said, okay, if you don't want to do it, we'll just, you know, whatever. And I said, okay, maybe I'll do this much. And little by little, it was not easy.
Mm-hmm. Well done.
Boy,
and I was going to say, apocalyptic indiscretion can be the new subtitle.
I have a question, actually. So, Hugh had heart bypass surgery around the same time, right? Now, I didn't come into the family until just before the film was done, really, I guess, mm-hmm. right? It was released in 85?
Yes.
Yeah, so I was married in 84. So I had no part in this, so I'm not really sure why I'm sitting here. But but he had heart bypass surgery, quadruple bypass. Was that before or after Egypt?
It was fairly soon after Egypt. He had his bypass. I can remember when it happened because his bypass was scheduled, and then it was announced that his surgeon was being called to be an apostle. So it happened in that time. It was one of the last surgeries that Russell Nelson did before he entered the Quorum of the Twelve. And we were in Egypt the first 2 weeks of 1984. So all that time that he was running around in the ruins, and when we got him really exhausted, so we got the Abraham story out of him, it's because he had four clogged arteries at that time, and you know, felt a lot better after the bypass surgery. But yeah,
where did Egypt fall in the production schedule? That was near the end.
That was the last. That was the last shooting we did, other than some B-roll.
We'd done all the interviews, I think, on the soundstage at the BYU Motion Picture mm-hmm. Studio.
That happened in 83.
The BYU Motion Pictures, yeah.
Yeah.
And then we did Egypt and France.
In one trip, yeah.
Yeah, in the same trip.
Yeah. So that was, and then there were a few B-roll shots, the Oregon stuff, things like that, and that was shot second unit, or Bells Bryan went and did it.
Yeah,
Hugh didn't go to Oregon. You were talking about how you picked the sequences thematically in the interviews. How did you pick the subjects? Because it seems like a tour through the collected works of Hugh Nibley. You've got Approaching Zion, you've got Temple and the Cosmos. Was that...
This was before Approaching Zion was compiled.
That's true.
You understand. This was before there was a collected works of Hugh Nibley. So those books that they scanned over were... the opus as it existed at that point.
Yeah.
Those were the topics that we felt were the ones he tended to hit on. And frankly, they're the ones that we found interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I personally am not very interested in Hugh Nibley as an intellectual. You know, that side of him is not that interesting to me. So that was, you know, I wanted to get things like the near-death experience, his attitudes on environmentalism and things like that. What was...
Well, and we... my memory's getting a little foggy on this, but Alex is absolutely right. We selected a series of topics, mm-hmm. And we tried to connect the topics to some experience in his life, and we weren't always able to do that, which is part of the reason we decided to go to Egypt. Was to make a very strong connection visually with his work on the Book of Abraham. But it was interesting. There were also some places where we kind of got hammered by the university. We did an interview with, actually, and since we're here at the University of Utah, it's probably well to acknowledge this, we did an interview with Sterling McMurrin about his association with Hugh. And McMurrin said some very interesting things. In the interview, he referred to Hugh as a mystic. And when a particular university vice president saw that interview in a cut that we did, he immediately said, that's not going to stay in the film. We can't have our top scholar at the university referred to as a mystic. And then we also, Hugh also said for the film, some even more scathing things than ended up in the final version about the military and about our tendency to be warlike. And there was a major objection raised by the ROTC on campus at BYU, and that material ended up getting cut out of the film as well. I remember, too, at one point when we approached Truman Matson about being interviewed, Truman's suggestion was that we create a slideshow. He thought it would be perfectly adequate just to shoot a series of slides and put in some pictures of Egypt and do some interviews with Hugh, and we'd be fine. So we had a little difficulty navigating the waters with this, for sure.
Boyd, you tell me, knowing his body of work as no one does better than you, how do you feel the film represents him? I have some, as a filmmaker now who's a lot older than when he made this film, there are certain points of dissatisfaction, but I'd like to hear from you on that.
Well, I was inspired by the film. When I when I got married to Zina, I didn't really know who Hugh Nibley was.
Did you mention that he's part of the family?
Did I mention he's a son-in-law?
Yeah, I married Zina, who's Alex's sister.
So Zina, you kept all this quiet, right, until you got married?
I think that's why she liked me, is that I wasn't trying to get, you know, the family relationship. So I didn't really know who he was, and I started reading his work. I read his Book of Mormon stuff, and I read Farms was just going, as you mentioned, and they were sending out Xerox copies. You could get Xerox copies of these obscure talks that he'd given, just transcripts, really. And so I read everything I could get my hands on. And the thing that, when I saw the film, the thing that really resonated with me is that there was the man behind that stuff that really came out. It was a much more personal approach. And as you mentioned already, Hugh was not exactly an approachable person. He was a wonderful man, and I loved him dearly, and I could tell that we had a relationship. But it was a relationship that you didn't really, I don't know, how would you put it? He was very emotional, but he would not express emotion very easily.
And he guarded his most precious inner stuff very, very carefully. Yeah. And I didn't see it, you know, really until I was, you know. And even then you saw little glimpses. You know, the moment where he chokes up talking about Abraham, that's pretty much as you got on in a good decade.
Well, and Zina, I mean, I remember we went to the first screening of the film, and Zina felt really, I hope she doesn't hate me for saying this, but I know Zina felt somewhat troubled because this was the first time she had seen her father in tears, and it was in public with all these other people around her. And, you know, here this was this intimate moment with her father, and she was sharing it with everybody on the BYU campus.
5,000 of my closest friends.
Yeah, 5,000 of her closest friends, people she'd never met. And so, you know, he was not a terribly easy person to get to know in a very intimate way. But I felt like the film really captured him in a way that you didn't get in the writings. The other thing that I found really interesting is that his memory was so amazing. That when he recounted some of these events in the film, like the Feather River, not only does he get details right, when I started doing research for the book, I found his recollection was accurate, but also the way he talked about it was the same. Maybe I can share just one quick story. I found a letter that he wrote when he was there at the Feather River with his grandfather's logging company. And so this was written August 4th of 1925, when Hugh was 15 years old. And, you know, so I was really quite surprised about, you know, his recollection, but also, again, the way his perception of those events really hadn't changed any. So let me just read a little snippet. He's writing to his mother, who's telling him he has to come home to go back to school. He says, "Dear mother, what's all this business about coming home? Let me live in paradise while it lasts. I climbed the Jackson Peak Sunday, and when I looked around, I saw not the great gray-green expanse of forest I had expected, but hundreds of miles of rocks and stubble, broken here and there by well-thinned plains of dry pines. This would have been most disappointing had it not been for the presence of one great patch of woods. What a heaven it was to look down onto the blue tops of those great cool firs and know that there in her last stronghold lives nature with all her great family. For to this citadel had flocked all the hosts of the forest. Here in the cold green temple, oozing and dripping with the licentious profusity of life, I felt as if I were a trillion years old. Nothing seemed strange or unusual. This is the only unlogged track within 50 miles of here, 500 million feet of it, and owned the devil damn it black," Shakespeare puts in parentheses, by the Nibley Stoddard Lumber Company. Soon it will be leveled to a desert. The streams will dry up and leave it to the sun, the sagebrush, the snakes, and the lizards. I mean, so not only had his... That's a 15-year-old, by the way. not only had his perception of that event been accurate, but, you know, the letter he wrote at the same time expressed that same kind of anxiety, that really strong, open environmentalist attitude toward it, and the sadness of seeing that forest disappear. So, the film was not only, I thought, a really good, intimate portrait of somebody that's hard to get intimate with, but it was so consistent with what I found in the writings that I later discovered that it was really quite remarkable.
So can I ask about Zionist 5,000 Friends? What was the reception? Did it make people more intimately aware of him as a person, do you feel? Yeah. Or what kind of feedback did anyone
receive? Well, you probably have better feel for that than I do.
I think we were all... I mean, again, I was pretty new to this. I had been to maybe a couple of lectures where Hugh had spoken and seen that there was kind of a devoted following. But when we assembled in that theater, we'd had a little party, if I remember right, beforehand. And then we walked in and we had seats reserved, you know, because we were the family members. And I remember, just being kind of in awe when I walked into this theater and saw all these people, because it was pretty good. It was in the Kimball Tower Auditorium.
It was in the Joseph Smith Building.
Joseph Smith Building?
That's right. Yeah, the old Joseph Smith Building.
Yeah.
But
it's a big auditorium, and there were all these people in there. And then the lights went down, and we saw the film. And after it, you know, I think everybody was just kind of, there was just this moment of kind of silence as the, you know, as the credits ran and then when it went off and then the applause broke out. And I think all of us felt deeply moved by that moment, including Hugh. I was sitting not far from where he was, and I could see his, he when he got anxious, you know, he'd shuffle. He'd get kind of this, he did that throughout the entire film. But at the end, I remember him kind of, there was a kind of beam to, you know, he seemed like he was pretty pleased with it.
Did he ever say as much? Or that's the best we know.
Well, all I know is he didn't stop talking to me. That's the only measure I had.
That's good. I want to open it to questions, but first, Alex, you had an announcement about
I do, actually.
And cut footage.
One of the things that I might have done right, I don't know, but I had worked into the contract I had on this film that no one could recut the footage or use the footage without permission of the family. Well, BYU Motion Picture Studio got tired of storing it, so they finally just gave it to us and said, get this out, take this away. So we've been hanging on to this film for some time now, and I've tried a lot of different avenues. I finally, we were able to get a grant from a gentleman in Provo named Richard Martin. And we are now going to be working with the UVU, the Utah Valley University Library, to digitize all of the footage, which means there are over 10 hours of interviews. I don't know exactly, but there are many, many hours of interviews that nobody has ever seen before that are on 16-millimeter film, and that we will now digitize. And what we do with that afterwards is a good question. There's the potential for at least one other documentary in there, I think, maybe. If not, we're also doing a series of enhanced e-books, which is e-books that have video clips in them. Of his, we have an agreement with Deseret Book, where we can take essays out of the collected works and create these enhanced e-books. We've done one already, which is Beyond Politics, which includes some video, which is an interview with Senator Bob Bennett, kind of arguing with Dad posthumously. And we're going to be doing things like that. So that's very exciting. That just happened in the last week or so that I finally got an agreement that we will be able to get that film digitized, which means I won't have to keep worrying about it deteriorating and storing it in my basement. The other thing that's kind of interesting, not completely related, this is a book nobody has seen yet. It will be on the shelves in Deseret and other places on Monday morning. It's called The Essential Nibley. And one of the things we've been trying to do as a family is to acquaint a newer generation, a younger generation, a more wired generation with Hugh Nibley. So we have a Twitter feed that my sister provides most of the tweets for it. Yay, Rebecca, at Hugh Nibley. We have a blog at hughnibley.net where it's mostly unpublished, previously unpublished stuff that we put up there. And this book, which is excerpts from the entire 19-volume collected works, arranged categorically. This is Nibley light, but hopefully not dumbed down. But we wanted to do it for people who are basically, because there's a large intimidation factor. There are a lot of people who are just scared to pick up one of those big books that cost $60 and, you know, you put on your bookcase, on your coffee table. So this is kind of to acquaint a new audience and introduce and maybe serve as a gateway drug to some people.
The film can work that way as well. My first, before I'd read anything, I knew the name, but I saw the film before I read anything.
And by the way, getting all this stuff digitized gives us the opportunity to create a Blu-ray version of this, which would be much better quality than this DVD version.
Right.
And we can there's some things we can clean up and fix and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and Jack Welch and others would probably be very amenable to doing that. Yeah.
And I just want to say as my final comment that Becky's still my favorite Cordelia.
Yeah.
Are there any questions? Yeah, go ahead.
I guess I'm one of those hardheads who's read all of it. although, gave much on my bookcase.
You're a better man than I am.
Well, it was such a delight to discover that one could have a mind and still be solid LDS. Really nice. The question I had is, I have been to Egypt, and I've been in the Egyptian library. How in the devil did you get permission to film there? As one question, and the second question is, how in the world did you keep up with him pottering around all that stuff?
With heart condition.
One of the things I understood about making this kind of film is that if you go to a place like Egypt, you have to have a fixer. And you'll see a credit here for a gentleman named Ahmed Sami, who was a production manager in Cairo and had worked on a lot of Hollywood films like Death on the Nile and so forth. And so I contacted him through a friend of mine in Los Angeles. And he's the one who got us access everywhere we went, at the Tomb of Eunice in Saqqara, and the Temple of Dendera, and we were in Luxor, obviously. So it was through a fixer, and he did a great job for us. Yeah,
I remember when we shot at Giza, we hired the local sheikh through Ahmed.
Whose land it was.
Yes, and he was the sheikh of that area, and he came and sat on a prayer rug on our production set through the day. And the point being that nobody bothered us as long as the sheikh was there. We also found that in the museum, we had certificates signed by the Ministry of the Interior and all kinds of things that Ahmed had done. But still, any guard who didn't like what we were doing could stop us. So we also had to do a certain amount of diplomatic footwork. I was doing still photography along with other things, and I would go around and just take snapshots, let the guards line up and take snapshots and shake their hands and meet them, and just to make friends. And then they wouldn't stop us when we went to shoot places. But it's not. By the way, that's Tahrir Square, where we were there, the where he was walking through there to the library.
We happened to be there during the revolution and spent a night at the Cairo airport with 3,400 of our closest friends.
Yeah.
Incidentally, you can no longer get to Dendera because that's in an area controlled by Arab fundamentalists who do not like American tourists.
Yeah, Sterling's producing work there was, to get Ahmed Sami was, no way we could have done that without him.
Yeah. And this was, how many times had you been to Egypt?
This was the first.
That was the first time he'd been to Egypt. He had been to Israel and Jordan, you know, but I don't think he hadn't been to Egypt.
Was that the
that
last
was
time?
One of the reasons. That was one of the ways we were able to get him to
go along with it.
Go along. There was a certain interest there.
My biggest fear on the whole project, and I had this recurring image, and it was the headline in the Deseret News that said, "Kinubli dies with Mormon film crew." that haunted me through that whole trip. That was not pleasant.
Yeah. There was another question back here. Yes.
Yeah. Do you think there might be a Nibley type scholarship revival, especially at BYU, that's sort of become like a junior high as far as knowing anything? Because I went down to one department where I'm supposedly an expert, got a PhD in the field, and said, "Why don't you have blah, blah, blah scholarship?" He said, "No, we're just here teaching stuff for business, just to make money." He didn't say it in those words, but that's what came out of it. And when you said, I was sort of one of his disciples, I took all his classes over and over again, and I took a trip with him to L.A., and we went to Midway Park in Glendale, where I'm from, and hung around there and stuff like that. But he always said that people aren't interested in this kind of stuff then. That was in the 60s. How about now? Nobody's interested in anything except the dollar and like what's on TV and how you can be like that by having that car and having that chick on TV that blood's dripping out of her mouth, some burger. I mean, that's all we care about. What happened to nobody? Is there going to ever be scholarship back at BYU again?
Is that a rhetorical question, or is that
the Maxwell Institute have a...
Are we all just
going to
get dumber?
I believe so, yeah.
Well, that movie, Dumber.
I only teach at BYU part-time, so I feel like I can.
It's a general question.
The Maxwell Institute does have still a Nibley scholarship that they do, where they fund, help fund graduate work in fields that are similar to Hugh Nibley's work. I actually got... graduate money from the Nibley Scholarship when I was going to grad school. So that's one way I think that this happens. But, you know, I can't, as a person who teaches college, I have to say, I think one of the real problems with the new generation, sounding like an old fart here, I guess, but they don't read the same way we did. You know, they don't sit down and read a book. They read a Twitter feed. And so I think the way Becky and Alex are doing this with the blog and the tweets, I think this is one way of making that stuff known and hopefully getting them a fix for getting into the deeper stuff. I'm really excited about seeing this film come out again. I actually try to show it to my classes at BYU when I teach there, and when I teach Mormon Lit, I usually show it.
And I saw it in a documentary film class at BYU.
Yeah. So I think the film is terrific. One of the problems, though, is since it came out on DVD, the quality isn't as good as it was when it was on video. So I'm really excited about the idea of a Blu-ray, because it just looks so fuzzy now, and it was such a beautiful film when I first saw it. It's, I mean, the footage in Egypt is just vibrant and so rich, and even in the studio, the footage is just really beautiful. I mean,
that's Brian Kapner's work. That was
was just so stunning, and so it pains me sometimes to see it now because it's so fuzzy. So I'm really thrilled to hear that we're going to get that digital cleaned up.
One last question, anyone? Yeah.
So, what was the final budget? Did BYU come up with the funds?
Took it out of his royalties. So they took it out of his royalties.
Took it out of our royalties. There were really two sources of money for the film. One was for the university, and they did pony up for I can't remember how much it was. And then because BYU owned the BYU Motion Picture Studio at the time, they gave us all of their cameras, their post production facilities as an in kind contribution, which allowed us to finish the film. So I think the budget probably at the end of the day would have been somewhere in the neighborhood. An appallingly small number, like about $60,000 or something.
That's low.
Did you take a salary? I don't remember taking a salary.
I think we got some honorarium type stuff.
Yeah, you got maybe $1,000 or something. It wasn't much.
But the whole process was how long? How much of your life did you devote to that?
It's over a year.
Oh, it was well over a year. I probably started, you know, this whole thing around in 1982, and we started rolling a little bit in 19. And we did our main interviews at the end of 1983, and then we did the trip in early 84, and then it was another year of Pete working on it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if, what would this cost to shoot today? This cost, what, $2 million?
Oh no, but the numbers would certainly be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars to do what we did if we had to pay for everything.
Mm-hmm. Well,
$400,000 or $500,000 maybe.
Yeah, money well spent. Thank you all for coming and joining us. So we're in the